This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 59th episode. Today, we return to the JCNM to look at a recent investigation that tries to illuminate the relationship between serum testosterone and fractures in men. Ever since the release of the Traverse fracture findings last year, we as endocrinologists have been uncertain as to how to think about testosterone and bone health, as that trial made us question what we thought we already knew. So, we thought that this article would be an important one to review and are eager to discuss it. Importantly, this is an observational study, not a clinical trial, so we will need to keep in mind those limitations that are intrinsic to such investigations and how they might impact the conclusions the authors draw. As a brief reminder, I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as a general endocrinologist and medical director. Back with us today is the podcast's most seasoned regular contributor, Anna Goldman. She comes to us from Boston, where she is in practice, teaches at Harvard Medical School, and attends at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. She focuses much of her clinical care in the field of reproductive endocrinology, so her expertise will aid us greatly today. As our guest expert for this month, Peter Snyder joins us. He needs no introduction to you all as our listener, so I will be quite brief. He has been at the University of Pennsylvania for many years, where he focuses his care on male reproductive endocrinology in addition to bone and pituitary disease. As we will hear more about shortly, his clinical investigation work shapes the way male reproductive endocrinology is treated today. He is an in-demand speaker and has published numerous papers, including key clinical guidelines. So, as usual, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to unpack this study. Everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Our article today will be Associations of Serum Testosterone in SHBG with Incident Fractures in Middle-Aged to Older Men, which is a forthcoming article in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. Louise Granamo at the University of Gothenburg and Ross Marriott at the University of Western Australia served as the first authors for this paper. I will now turn the conversation over to Anna. She will walk us through the authors' introduction to highlight some of the key points that they make, and will also ask Peter to give us additional background on this topic. Anna?
Thanks, Chase. So osteoporotic or fragility fractures increase with age due to multiple factors, which may include loss of bone mineral density, deterioration of bone microarchitecture, and increased propensity to fall. Although osteoporotic fractures are more common in women, and we as physicians tend to focus more on fracture risk in postmenopausal women, up to 1 in 4 men will have an osteoporotic fracture during their lifetime, and they have increased mortality following a fracture, which is particularly concerning. As men age, their circulating testosterone decreases, sex hormone binding globulin, or SHBG, increases, and their risk of fracture increases. It's unclear if circulating testosterone, independent of comorbidities, increases fracture risk in older men, as prospective observational trials have shown inconsistent results. In contrast, most prospective observational studies have consistently demonstrated that high circulating SHBG with low calculated free testosterone is associated with increased fracture risk in men. Peter, could you please comment on what is known about the impact of aging on testosterone levels in men?
So as men get older, their serum testosterone concentrations decrease, but only slightly. But also, as you mentioned, as men age, their SHBG increases, so that the concentration of free testosterone decreases more, about 30% from age 40 to age 80. The question is, does this decrease in free testosterone have any clinical effect, or any of the effects we associate with aging due to this decrease in free testosterone?
In symptomatic men who have hypogonadism due to aging, testosterone treatment has been shown to improve bone mineral density. And this was most clearly seen in the T trials, which Dr. Snyder spearheaded, where 1 year of testosterone gel increased volumetric bone mineral density and estimated bone strength in older men with low testosterone. However, this trial was not large enough nor long enough to determine whether testosterone replacement therapy impacts fracture risk. When the fracture subtrial of TRAVERSE, a large randomized controlled trial treating greater than 5,000 men with hypogonadism and high cardiovascular risk, was published last year, I know I was quite surprised to see not only that testosterone did not lower fracture risk, but that the incidence of fracture was actually higher among men receiving testosterone compared with placebo. Peter, as the first author of this publication, what are your hypotheses about this unexpected finding?
Well, the investigators were also surprised because of the prior studies showing that testosterone increases every aspect of bone that one can measure: areal bone density, volumetric bone density, trabecular architecture, estimated strength by finite element analysis. We hypothesized that testosterone would reduce fracture risk. Therefore, we designed the study to determine by how much testosterone would decrease fracture risk. The TRAVERSE trial was the first trial of testosterone ever to be large enough and long enough to answer this question. So when the trial was finished and the blind was broken and the unblinded statistician Kevin Buehrer presented us with the results showing testosterone increased fracture risk, we said to him, "Kevin, you mixed up the results." He said, "No, the men with increased fracture risk had higher testosterone levels. I didn't mix up the results." So because we didn't expect those results, we didn't build in to the trial any measures that might answer your question of by what mechanism did testosterone increase fracture risk. We had to guess. We had to guess why testosterone increased fracture risk. And we had only one guess. Testosterone increased men's sense of well-being. Therefore, they increased their activity, and they increased their activity and therefore had more fractures. But of course, that's only a guess. There is one piece of evidence in the trial that does comport with that guess, and that is if one looks at the cumulative incidence of fractures over time, one sees that the men who were treated with testosterone increased their rate of fracture even within the first 2 months of treatment. So that's soon enough that it's earlier than one would expect testosterone to have an effect on the structure of bone, on the quality of bone. And that fits with the guess that testosterone increased men's activity, and that's how it increased fracture risk.
So it seems that prior observational studies have included men with different pathologies and risk factors that could affect the impact of testosterone on bone, although we know this is less of a concern in the well-matched T trials and TRAVERSE trial. But the role of exogenous and endogenous testosterone on fracture risk in men remains unclear. So the main aim of the present study was to determine the associations of endogenous circulating testosterone, SHBG, and calculated free testosterone with incident fractures at different bone sites in men using the UK Biobank.
Anna and Peter have well outlined the controversy here, or at least the lack of understanding of mechanisms, and so I think highlights why we were eager to tackle this study to see if it gave us any insight into what might be going on in that relationship between testosterone and bone health in men. For a quick look at the methodology of this study, we'll start with thinking about the study design. I think this is best described as a retrospective cohort study. The authors, as they describe this, they first of all talk about where the subjects come from, and that's the UK Biobank. And they describe that as a prospective cohort study. And I think that that's an accurate way of describing how those patients are enrolled and how they are followed over time. It was a little bit unclear. It is possible that this study is also prospective, but frequently in these large biobank type studies is that once an investigator gets an idea, they can go back and pull data from this. So sometimes it's actually a retrospective look at data that is prospectively collected. I don't think it makes a big difference here, but it was not totally clear to me exactly how the authors approach this. But as a reminder, at least of how cohort studies work in general, the key is that you have to be able to follow individuals over time. And that can be in real time. You can follow along with them in a prospective study, or if you can at least reestablish that time component, then you can do that in a retrospective fashion. But a key, the cohort part of that, is that you have to split subjects into at least two groups, exposed and unexposed. And sometimes you can have multiple groups if you're able to break up that exposure into different degrees. And then you follow them over time. You confirm that they do not have an outcome of interest at the beginning of the study when they are enrolled. And then you follow them over time, waiting for them to develop the outcome of interest. And then after the study is over, you simply look to say, okay, I have an exposed group, I have an unexposed group. Did one group have the outcome of interest more than the other one did? And that's what's done here. So as a quick look at that UK Biobank, so it's a very large study. The number of participants that they were able to pull into this was quite large. So they had well over 200,000 individuals. And then specifically looking at individuals who had a fracture, there were over 11,000 fracture cases. So large numbers here. To go into those variables of interest that I alluded to before by category. So first of all, the exposure. So this is what's going to decide which group you end up in this cohort study. What the authors used was total testosterone, SHBG, and calculated free testosterone. And the authors described the method that they use for that calculation of the free testosterone. It used the total testosterone, the SHBG, and albumin. And additionally, the authors comment that these labs were collected throughout the day. So Peter, question for you here, I guess a compound question. I've got a few things to throw at you. One of them, I'm interested in your thoughts about this method of determining free testosterone and if there's anything that we need to be aware of about how this is done in this study. And then also this additional comment that the labs were collected throughout the day and not at least how we as endocrinologists would typically prefer that they be fasting morning values. So a couple of questions to throw out at you about how these labs were collected and measured.
So calculating free testosterone using the total testosterone and SHBG by the method of Vermeulen is a well-known method. It's been used by many investigators, many clinical laboratories, since Professor Vermeulen first proposed it several decades ago. But one should realize there are six other formulae for calculating free testosterone, and they give wildly different results. So this method probably does not give the true free testosterone. On the other hand, they use this method for everybody in the study. So probably any differences they saw or lack of differences are not due to this method because it wasn't the best method, but it was consistent. The fact that blood was drawn at any time during the day is more of a problem with regard to interpreting the results. As we endocrinologists know, since Bill Bremner first described 4 decades ago that serum testosterone concentrations in men are highest early in the morning and then fall gradually during the next 12 hours, that if one wants to determine if someone is secreting subnormally, then it's best to measure at a time when that hormone is highest. And in the case of testosterone, it's best to measure it early in the morning when it's going to be highest, if one is looking to distinguish between subnormal and normal. So the fact that testosterone was measured at any time during the day means that they were less likely to detect subnormal values and distinguish those from normal values, or less likely to distinguish men who were somewhat hypogonadal from men who were normal.
Peter has highlighted an important point in thinking about the differences in accuracy and bias here. He pointed out that since this approach was used equally in all of the groups, we don't need to be worried about a bias. A bias in a research study is when one group is treated differently from another, and that can be intentional. It's often done unintentionally. But if it's something that's applied equally, even if perhaps there are concerns about the accuracy or the precision of an approach, if it's done with everyone, then there's much less of a concern about it having introduced a bias into your investigation. That's the exposure. So now we'll think about the outcome as is described here by the authors, and that's looking at fractures. The authors report that they were looking at incident fractures, and that started from when the study began, which is anywhere from March of 2006 up through October 2010 until the censoring date from that UK biobank in each country, which was either in 2022 or 2023. These fractures were identified using ICD codes from hospital admissions, and that included hospital admissions with an ICD code for any fracture or for hip fracture or a forearm fracture. All of those were looked at. Finally, the other thing that always has to be considered in observational studies is the impact of confounders. And again, that's things that you have not labeled as an exposure, but could track along with an exposure, and if not accounted for, could make you think that an exposure is actually driving an outcome. So the authors describe the covariates. So this is what they plugged into their statistical analysis. They had quite a few, a lot of ones that you would anticipate, things like age, BMI, waist circumference, ethnicity, physical activity, and smoking status. A few other things of note, the authors used total number of medications as a proxy for overall comorbidity status. They also identified individuals with secondary osteoporosis, for example, from glucocorticoid use or type 1 diabetes, and that was used through pulling data from this biobank study. They also grouped participants by the geographic regions from which they came. I want us to pause just a second and get any other input from Peter and Anna about any other things that should have been thought about. One that came to mind for me, and this happens all the time with cohort studies, so this isn't, say, an issue with what the authors did. This is baked into cohort studies, but this is a very long study. So this studied individuals for many, many years. But the data of interest, so the testosterone levels, were measured at baseline, and this could have been well over a decade removed from when the individual might have a fracture. Again, that's pretty typical. You have to split individuals into groups at the beginning of your cohort study, so that's something that we always have to think about here. But maybe we'll start with you, Peter. Any thoughts that you had, any other information that you might have liked to have been considered as a confounder here?
I can't think of any others that they should have. I think they were actually exhaustive in the number of variables for which they considered.
And any additions from you?
Yeah, the only thing that would have been interesting to me was the presence of type 2 diabetes, just because insulin resistance can also impact SHBG. So that was the only other thing that I would have wanted to see.
I'll concur with Peter. I think they did a very good job. The authors discussed this at the end in their discussion as a real strength, that they had a lot of data that they were able to account for. So I do think their adjusting for confounders was a real strength. Comment briefly on how they actually do that at a very high level as we talk about their statistical analysis. The authors use what they describe as four different models for adjusting for these confounders. This is also where they introduce some exclusion criteria, and we'll hear a little bit about that from Anna. One of the reasons I really like it when authors have these multiple models is it allows you as a reader to get a sense of the impact of these confounders. And the way that works is typically in the first model that an author will use, they either have no confounders or just a few basic ones that they introduce. And then as they go from model to model, they typically introduce more and more confounders. And that helps you as a reader, because if you look at that first model where there's few or no confounders accounted for, and if you see that there seems to be a really big difference, the outcome happens much more frequently in, say, the exposed group as compared to the unexposed group. But then as the models go along and more confounders are added, if that difference gets closer and closer to zero, so that there is not a difference between the groups, you get very worried that this relationship is being driven by confounders. Observational studies always have residual confounding. The authors point that out for their investigation, as they should. And so you get worried that if at the end, once that last model is utilized, if the difference is relatively small, that maybe that residual difference is just made up from these residual confounders. So that big shift from model to model worries you. On the flip side, if as the authors introduce more and more confounders, if that difference stays the same or actually even gets bigger, that is reassuring. It's not a slam dunk either way. Neither of those findings makes you convinced that something is a genuine finding or not, but it very much helps you understand the impact of confounders. So I think it's a real strength that the authors do that here. With that, we'll wrap up the methodology. I'm going to hand things back over to Anna, and she's going to walk us through the results that the authors present.
So data was available for 229,066 men. Then excluding men who were taking testosterone replacement therapy or they were on antiandrogens like spironolactone or 5-alpha reductase inhibitors or other hormonal medications, or men who had known pituitary disease or infertility or they were already on osteoporosis medications, led to a reduction to 221,597 people remaining. Additional exclusions due to missing data led to further decreases. So the N for testosterone analyses was 205,973 men. For SHBG analyses, 190,607 men. And for calculated free testosterone, the N was 189,585 men. The analysis cohort comprised men who were middle to older age, ranging from 37 to 73, with a median age of 58 years, and the duration of follow-up was 13.6 years. During follow-up, 11,088 men, or 5%, recorded a fracture at any bone site. There were 1,680 hip fractures and 1,366 forearm fracture cases. For testosterone associations not considering SHBG, there was a nonlinear association with hip but not forearm fractures, with the lowest risk in the second quintile. However, in models adjusted for SHBG or using a calculator-free testosterone, lower T was associated with a higher risk for fractures at all evaluated bone sites. Lower SHBG was strongly associated with a lower risk of hip and forearm fractures. Further adjustments for FRAX-related predictors did not result in substantively different estimates. Lower SHBG concentrations were strongly associated with lower risk of any hip and forearm fractures. The hazard ratio for any fracture for quintile 1 versus quintile 5 was 0.71. The hazard ratio for hip fracture was 0.55, and the hazard ratio for forearm fractures was 0.62. Using calculated free testosterone, lower calculated free testosterone was associated with a higher risk for fractures at all evaluated bone sites, and the estimated associations for calculated free testosterone with risk of fracture at different bone sites resembled those for testosterone adjusted for SHBG, with a hazard ratio of 1.24 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.16 to 1.33 for quintile 1 versus quintile 5. So I'll hand it back to you, Chase, for the discussion.
A lot of data that Anna just went through for us. So now we're going to put it all together, or at least I'm going to give you how the authors put it all together, and then we're going to think about that carefully. So I'll give you a couple of quotes from the authors as they start their discussion, their main findings. So first of all, the authors state that adjustment for SHBG revealed inverse associations of circulating testosterone with the risk of fractures at all three bone sites. And then additionally, these findings demonstrate that circulating SHBG rather than testosterone is a major independent biomarker of fracture risk in men. The authors then go on to do what I would describe as a mechanistic discussion. This is very typical in papers. The authors want to build a case for the biologic plausibility of their findings. And so they point out a few things. First of all, they pull in other data, other research studies, and in that they say that other data does suggest that SHBG is not just a marker of poor health. Additionally, they point out that SHBG may be mediating the effects of fracture risk by modulating the effects of testosterone and estradiol. Finally, another speculation from them is that SHBG could even be exerting a direct effect. So, Peter, wanted to get your input here on these proposed mechanistic explanations. They give a couple here. Do these make sense? Do you buy them? Do you have any concerns or hesitancy about thinking, okay, yeah, that could be the explanation for the findings here? What are your thoughts?
SHBG, as we've mentioned, is a carrier protein. It carries testosterone around in the blood. It has no biologic effect. It's possible that it does, but it doesn't have any known biologic effect. So we know that if SHBG concentration goes up and it binds more testosterone, that lowers the free testosterone concentration. That increases LH secretion, which increases testosterone production by the Leydig cell. And the net result is that the total testosterone becomes higher than normal, the percent free becomes lower than normal, and the absolute free testosterone concentration becomes normal. So it doesn't make sense that any increase or decrease in SHBG would have any biologic effect at all. It wouldn't increase the effect of testosterone. It wouldn't decrease the effect of testosterone. So my thinking is that the relationship between SHBG and fractures is an indirect one, that they're both markers for the same biologic process. Now, what biologic process? We don't know. One example is that if someone was exposed to increased testosterone, for example, that would lower SHBG. So that could be a relationship. But basically, I think that the relationship between SHBG and fractures is indirect. They're both the result of something else, but we don't know what that something else is.
And at the end, we will come back to how our understanding of that might need to change our clinical practice, or perhaps not quite yet. But before we do that, we will go on through the author's discussion. They then go on to talk about the strengths. We've mentioned a few of these already, but the authors point out that the strength of their study is a large number of subjects, and additionally, that there was a long follow-up. As we've also discussed, they had a detailed characterization of their subjects and also had a fairly high number of fractures. Finally, they point out that they had a sophisticated statistical approach that allowed for imputation of missing information. Some limitations that the authors point out, again, as we've discussed, residual confounding always has to be a concern in observational studies, in addition to just the fact that this is an observational study in and of itself. Some more specific issues that the authors point out is that data on bone mineral density and falls was not available, and additionally, there was not data on estradiol or DHT. The authors then go on in their conclusions to give what I would describe as first a summary and then an implication of their findings. So we'll start with what I would label as their summary, and I'll quote them here. Our results show that low circulating SHBG is strongly associated with a low risk of fractures in men. And the implication, as I would describe it here, again, I'll quote them, not only total testosterone, but also SHBG concentrations should be assessed when examining the relationship of endogenous testosterone concentrations with health outcomes influenced by androgen-sensitive tissues in middle age to older men. In a minute, we'll get to, as promised, thinking through the clinical implications of these findings. But before we do that, I just want us to think about this as a study, as a report in and of itself. Anna, let's start with you. You spent a lot of time analyzing this paper and then wrestling with different aspects of it. What are your thoughts about the quality of this report overall?
Again, the UK Biobank is a wonderful resource, and I think the authors did a really good job taking multiple confounders and covariates into consideration with this report.
Peter, thoughts about the quality of this report overall?
I think the quality is excellent. I think that one can be confident that the association that they've reported, that low SHBG is associated with low fracture risk, is valid. I think that the lack of association with testosterone is perhaps less valid because of what we discussed earlier, that testosterone was measured at any time of day and not early in the morning. But the association with SHBG, I think, is probably valid.
And I'll chime in on that. I agree. I think this is an extremely well done study. Observational studies are fraught with difficulties if you don't think through everything. And I thought the author did a great job to highlight the point that I made before about the use of the different models. I think that was a particularly good strength of this study and actually showed that even as they added more and more confounders, it didn't ship those results. They stayed remarkably stable, which really suggests that just like Peter said, there really is something that's going on here, that this isn't just an artifact of confounders that we didn't capture very well. There seems to be a true relationship between what has been labeled as the exposure and what has been labeled as the outcome here, the testosterone, particularly that SHBG and or calculated free testosterone and those fractures that are the outcomes of interest here. Now we'll move on to thinking about clinical implications of this. So in other words, should this change our practice? A couple of questions that I had just thinking about how the authors describe their work and how this could potentially be applied to clinical care would be questions like, do we need to move away from doing just total testosterone measurements? Or are we particularly worried that in a, say, a man that I'm seeing for osteoporosis, that if I just measured a total testosterone, that I might be missing the influence of SHBG or the true effect of free testosterone, however you want to think about that. And so my investigation needs to routinely be more thorough than that. I was also curious with the authors in that very last statement that we said, that implication, they really seemed to broaden their findings out. They didn't just focus on bone health, but talked about androgen-sensitive tissue, so suggesting much more than just bone health. So I was curious if we needed to expand our thinking related to free testosterone beyond simply bone health. So a couple of questions that I had, but Anna, we'll start with you. What are your thoughts on clinical implications here? Should we change our practice or not enough information yet to change what we're doing with patient care?
We know that there's generally a pretty linear relationship between free testosterone and total testosterone. It's expensive, it's time-consuming to measure a free testosterone by equilibrium dialysis, which is why we often rely on getting a calculated free testosterone. We know that when individuals have very high or very low SHBG levels, that it impacts the validity of using equations like vermulins. And so I already, when I suspect that somebody may have a high or low SHBG, get either a calculated free testosterone, or I have the benefit where I practice of being able to order a free testosterone by equilibrium dialysis, because I do often see a difference between total and free testosterone. And if we believe the free hormone hypothesis, I think free testosterone is more helpful. And we saw that in the analysis that the estimated associations for calculated free T with risk of fracture resembled those for testosterone adjusted for SHBG. So that's my thought.
All right, Peter, as our guest expert and somebody who has seen a lot of guys with testosterone issues, bone issues, and you wrestle with this a lot. So are the findings of this paper going to change how you approach this? Are they going to confirm what you do already? You're not going to have any impact? You're going to wait for more data or something else entirely? Give us your thoughts as we wrap up here about how we should be thinking about the clinical implications of this paper.
I agree with the authors. So let's go back to what you just read, the author's conclusions. The authors conclude that their results should influence what is measured in future studies. The authors make no claim as to how these results should influence clinical practice. This, as we've discussed many times now, this study was done in a general population. This study wasn't done in patients. These were not men who are hypogonadal, who had osteoporosis, were seeking medical care. This was a general population. And the authors conclude, I think very appropriately, that these results should influence future studies. These results tell us nothing about diagnosis in an individual patient. This study wasn't about treatment, so it wouldn't influence our treatment. So I'd say that this study should influence future studies, but at the present time, it should not influence current care.
And with that, I would like to thank Anna Goldman and Peter Snyder for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did and look forward to you all joining us again next month.
And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you by the Endocrine Society with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon. If you want to like and subscribe, you can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback on this episode or the podcast itself. Please email us at podcast@endocrine.org.
Endocrine Feedback Loop is a free service of the Endocrine Society. To learn more or to become a member, visit the Society's website at www.endocrine.org.